Thanks, Brad, band. That was awesome. I want to think with you about this idea of this road that we're on, this path that we're on, and what it means to see the world with the kind of eyes that see this radical friendship, right? It's kind of what we talk about all the time in here. How do we see the world, and how does it affect who we are and what we are in relationship to? What is the truth of that at the core of our being? That's what it means to be radical, to find that core. So I want to bring up this first slide here. The only certainty is uncertainty. Pliny the Elder, I'm sure you all know Pliny the Elder, read lots of his works. Pliny the Elder was actually a historian, first century Roman historian. It was interesting because I went back, I've seen quotes by Pliny the Elder, and of course he was in that period of time of Caesar and then later on after Caesar with Nero. And it's interesting that as you're reading his quote, I'm thinking about the Jews who were oppressed and under the oppression of the Roman Empire at that time, which really doesn't seem to be a part of his understanding. He really wasn't necessarily a sympathetic person to the concern of the Israelites. Instead, he was aware of the reality of his own oppression, which was, depending on who was the emperor at the time, your life could be easy or your life could be hell. And so under the first emperor, he was kind of considered somebody that someone would turn to for information, for historical facts or information in the Roman Empire. He was even given a seat in the Roman Empire and was sort of like the protectorate or the governor of a region that was kind of set up just for him. And then Nero came along. And literally, Pliny went into hiding and just did as little as he could to get noticed. You ever been in one of those positions where you've been in a situation and you kind of just decide, I just need to play it safe. I don't really need to get that much attention right now. And so this idea of everything, the only certainty is uncertainty, is kind of a reality that I think we can resonate with. And 2,000 years later, I wonder if we don't sort of feel that same reality ourselves. If we don't sort of have that same sense right now, as I mentioned earlier, things are always changing. Things are never quite consistent. Just when we're meeting together again, we're not wearing masks, we're, you know, hugging, we've been vaccinated 3 times, et cetera, it's, you know, boosted, et cetera. And now we've got this new thing, right? Well, we've had it now for a few weeks now. So we're just waiting. Now, the question that I have for you is, what's the difference between waiting and hope? Next slide, if we can, up here. Abraham Maslow. You guys know Abraham Maslow. I've talked about him before. Abraham Maslow was the psychologist that developed the hierarchy of needs and sort of looking at the top, or looking at the bottom, we have our basic survival needs, and then you move on up there, our connectional needs, our community needs, our relational needs. You keep moving up, self-actualization. You get up higher towards full actualization. He had this understanding of how people develop. But I thought it was interesting because he also says this thing that either you step forward into growth, or essentially what I would say, you step forward into uncertainty, or you step back into safety. I like the contrast between growth and safety. It's easy to think of being in a certain relationship with our world around us, stay familiar, stay connected to our tribe, our network, our way of thinking, right? I'm always saying, doesn't matter who put the bumper sticker on their car, beware the dangers of stupid people in large crowds. Who's the stupid people, right? We know who they are, they know who they are. The reality is they all are, we all are. That's the first lesson in sort of moving into uncertainty, is recognizing if we think only those folks are the stupid people, then we got a lot of learning. What's the truth at the core of our being? What's the truth at the core of our reality that invites us into uncertainty that we might endure what is hard to endure and bring about more radical friendship, more radical connection? That's really what this is about. It's easy enough to stay within the safe places. I got to thinking back about what we've been through just in this community and me as pastoring, trying to sort of pastor and run this community. You know, think about where we were almost 19 months ago. We weren't in here, were we? Do you remember all the videos that you watched online? Do you remember the pre-recorded services you watched online? The great videos that Brad and the band did, right? This whole other reality we lived, and now we've moved past it. It's almost like it didn't happen. Do you remember what it was like to sit in the round? It's been a while. We're going to get back to that. We are. We're going to get back to doing that. But it's been a while. That was our identity, looking at each other. Not looking at me so much. But now I'm on camera. A good half of us are watching on camera. We've kind of redesigned things to kind of create a hybrid reality here in this time that we're in. Let's see this next cartoon. You do realize you could just walk straight out of here. What makes you think I'd want to? I've often shared this story, this one story that my friend used to tell me when she was talking about people that she worked with addiction. I knew a woman who lived in hell, but she could never leave because she knew the street names too well. Right? We know what that's like, though. It doesn't take addiction. We're all a factor of our conditioning. Think about what motivates you, and I guarantee you can find some connection to your past in there. Think about how you see the world, and I guarantee you can see some aspect either that you rebelled against, that you redefined, or that you're still trapped to, or that you don't even realize that you're doing it. You can still see you're living out of conditioned realities. And it's not because emotionally, cognitively, we're deciding to do that. Sure, we do that, but the reality is our brain's already doing it for us. Because our brain operates out of an efficiency that sort of keeps everything familiar so that the body operates more efficiently, so that we operate in our realities more efficiently. That gets challenged all the time, right? Especially now, it gets challenged all the time. So that's why you notice when somebody says something that seems uncomfortable, you feel uncomfortable. It's biological, it's physiological, right? It starts to kick off. This isn't familiar, this doesn't resonate with my neural networks. And so we begin to deal with the unfamiliar. And we find something of that in this story, this mystical tale of Jesus when he offers this third practice. I call these spiritual practices. And you know why I'm calling these things spiritual practices, right? These things that I've already told you, like the first one was giving what is hard to give, giving away what you love, learning and paying attention to whether you operate out of motivations of love or do you operate out of motivations of fear, out of motivations of love, curiosity, attentiveness, kindness, openness, vulnerability, that's love. Or do you operate out of fear, greed, anxiety, defensiveness, rightness, that's fear, anger, hate. Do you operate out of love? Do you operate out of fear? What motivates all of our little moments? That's a practice. To do that requires practice. You know why? Because we've been conditioned for years and years to be a certain way. We have to be more mindful in practice. So I call it a spiritual practice. We won't all do it. It's hard. Even doing that kind of thing is hard. Think about how hard it is to go exercise, right? Just trying to see the world in a different way is challenging. So we find in this mystical tale of Jesus just that happening. Jesus is challenging the whole way of being in his context. Number one, there's a person there trapped, like he's in a jail. He's been trapped to his same pattern of relating to the world. He's immobilized, he's marginalized, he's physiologically crippled, you might say. But this is a mystical tale. It's not simply speaking of his physical impairment. It's speaking of the spiritual impairment that we also experience, that he was experiencing, that Jesus was experiencing in his day as the Roman Empire was oppressing the Israelites and as the Israelites were turning towards the temple and excluding everyone else from the direct experience of the divine, demanding sacrifice, demanding payments, demanding taxes, that sort of thing. And Jesus is all of a sudden healing on what? A Sabbath. So he's redefining God's relationship with the moment by addressing what's needed in the moment. And so he says, do you want to be healed? Well, he's been sitting there for 38 years. Have you ever looked back at your life and wondered, why do I keep doing this? Come on. You're not even moving. Is it because you know you all do it? Or is that, what is that? I mean, you know, I do it every single day. How did I get to this point in my week and I never got that done? Or that I'm just now doing this? How did I miss that? You know, we always look back. And then what do we do? Well, we move into these cycles, right? We either feel guilty, we feel defensive, or we project it outward. Now, I've already told you, I live out of shame. That's kind of been my orientation most of my life. It's rooted in how I was conditioned. It's something I deal with personally and will continue to, as I redefine my understanding of my relationship to myself and the world, to God, I have to pay attention to that pattern. Or I find myself there going like, how did I get here? Why did I do this again? Sometimes Linda and I will wake up in the morning, we'll get into a conversation and we'll just stop because it's like we're saying, yeah, I know. I said I'd stop doing this. And we just look at each other and kind of smile because we realize the first step is paying attention. The second step is to start paying attention on purpose and intentionally start to stopping these patterns by paying attention. So Jesus says, you've been here for 38 years. Do you really want to be made whole? It seems like certainty and crisis, I will say certainty and hopelessness, will always trump uncertainty and hope. Now, I want to say that again because I think sometimes we think of certainty as hope. But it's not. It's comfort. But it's a kind of hopelessness. Because when we get stuck in our certainty and we decide to move there for safety's purpose or because it feels too vulnerable and risky to move outside of it, we're really not moving into hope, are we? We're really resting in hopelessness. We do it all the time. To move into uncertainty is this idea of moving into actual hope, moving into growth. So we during this whole time of the pandemic, we've had to face all sorts of realities, but the spotlight was kind of shown, kind of forced us to look at ourselves. So we looked at the Me Too movement even more clarity, or we saw the Black Lives Matter crisis, or we saw literally the videos of Black Lives, of like George Floyd and so many others being actually murdered and actually abused, or we saw these kinds of things that just seemed like too much to not pay attention to, and how did we miss it before, that kind of thing. And then I remember what came out of all of this was this idea that perhaps there was some part that we play in this sin of what I call disconnection. I think this story in John's gospel presents a curious question for us about hope and enduring what is hard to endure. Do we really want to be made whole? And by that, I don't just mean you and me, because if we look at what the truth of the ground of our being is, and we look at the very core of reality that we are not separate, we are all part of the same reality, not just quantum physics, but we know this to be true. As we look at these other movements and crises and the environmental crises, we look at all of this, we are interconnected, as Martin Luther King said, inextricably so, our destinies intertwined. Do we really want to be made whole? That's essentially what this question, what this parable, or this story is asking. The mark of radical friendship, then, is enduring what is hard to endure. So what's the difference, then, between hope and optimism? It's a rhetorical question, but you can think about it. What's the difference between hope and optimism? Our son once, when he was being really grumpy, he was probably about 6 or so, Linda and I were in the car, and he was really being just grumpy, bitter. He didn't get what he wanted or something at school, so he's mad. So Linda, being the good teacher that she was, she smiled and she said, Tim, let me tell you something. You know, there's a way to be optimistic and there's a way to be pessimistic. Do you know what the difference of that is? And he's like, no. And she said, okay, well, listen. A pessimist is somebody who gets kind of what they wanted. They did get a lot of things during the day. They may have gotten a present that they asked for, but it wasn't exactly like it. It wasn't the right color. And so the pessimist is going like, it's not what I really wanted, but it's still really cool. That's a pessimist. The optimist is somebody who's promised a pony, but when they open up the box, it's just filled with horse manure, but they're diving in there going, there's a pony in here somewhere. She said, which would you rather be? And Tim smiled and said, I want to be an Episcopal. Now, you might think he didn't get it at all, but Tim has taught us over the years that there's a way of relating to life that says, just reframe the reality. If you're going to try to see things as binaries, just reframe it. You don't have to see your options as one or the other. Reframe reality the way you wish to see it happen. Be the change you wish to see, right? How do we reframe things in such a way that we literally begin to participate in the hope we want to see? Optimism is really more typically about wishful thinking. I sure hope it gets better. I sure hope we come around and figure out what's wrong with the environment and we can change things. I sure hope that we don't have these conflicts anymore. I sure hope my party wins in this kind of thing or that kind of thing. I mean, optimism is not the same thing as hope. Optimism is a kind of hopeless, wishful thinking that where we find a lot of ourselves in, kind of universally speaking. But hope is more of an active verb. Hope is something that we participate in when we envision that something can happen that isn't happening, and maybe we won't even see it ourselves. It's like the old man who was planting trees outside of the edge of the village, and the village governor came by and looked at him and said, "What are you doing out here? Why are you planting these trees?" Because the man was pretty old. And he says, "I'm planting these trees because we need trees." He says, "Yeah, but you're not even going to be around to sit underneath these trees." And the man smiled and he says, "Yeah, but I know these trees will be here. And so I'm already enjoying it." Hope is planting seeds for what we may not get the chance to experience, but we already know we're participating in a reality that will make a difference for the world. Martin Luther King, when he gave his Been to the Mountaintop speech, I was reading it the other day because, you know, we were celebrating Martin Luther King's birthday, but also just remembering many things. And I usually reread the Birmingham jail speech, the letter he wrote from Birmingham jail, but I'd never really read this speech again, his famous mountaintop speech. And he gave it just a few weeks before he was actually assassinated. He said, "Well, I don't know what will happen now. We've got some difficult days ahead, but it really doesn't matter with me now because I've been to the mountaintop, and I don't mind. Like anybody, I would like to live a long life. Longevity has its place. But I'm not concerned about that now. I just want to do God's will. And God has allowed me to go up to the mountaintop, and I've looked over the edge, and I've seen the promised land. And I may not get there with you, but I want you to know tonight that we as a people will get to the promised land. So I'm happy tonight. I'm not worried about anything. I'm not afraid. Mine eyes have seen the glory." When you think about this, it's almost prescient, isn't it? It's almost eerie. It's curious to me, too, because it's easy for me to think who was there in the crowd. The white and black people were there, both. Asian was a mixture of people in this crowd. He wasn't speaking to one particular people. He was speaking to all humanity, this vision, this interconnected possibility. We saw another milestone this week. I don't know how many of you noticed it because, honestly, it got past me. Rachel, let's see, I'm going to forget her name because I think it's Czech. But Rachel Bakalovic. Did y'all hear about her? No? First major baseball manager hired to manage a team. First woman hired to manage a baseball team, professional men's baseball team. Now, it's an A team. It's part of the Yankees A team, part of their whole corporation, you know, but they have an A team called the Tampa Tarpons, and she is now the general manager, not just the coach, not just managing something. She actually manages the whole team, many of which will become major league players. It's the first woman to ever have done so. A lot of people making a big deal about it. She was very quick to say, "I didn't do this. This has been done for me for the past couple of generations," right? There were little girls generations ago who wanted to play baseball and were told that's not what a girl does. There were little girls two generations ago who started playing softball. Maybe a generation ago who started playing professional softball. But did they ever dream about actually managing a men's team? I'm sure some did. That glass ceiling didn't get broken because Rachel decided, "I'm going to break this glass ceiling today." She lived into her dream. She lived into that possibility. The inclusion of LGBTQ individuals, the rights of individuals for marriage and for leadership in the church, in society as a whole, but especially in the Methodist Church, this has been going on for a generation or two, a couple of generations, right? It's been going on, struggling with that for a couple of generations. But you know, here's what's interesting. You and I already know the future, don't we? We already know the future. We already live as if that future is here in the Methodist Church. And it will be. It's taken forever. But it will be. This year, maybe. Next year, we hope. Who knows, because of the pandemic. But we're already living into it. We already have a new bishop now who's finally, but we already have a new bishop who's finally saying, "I'm not going to prosecute anybody because they marry two people who are in love. I'm not going to do it." We already have individuals in seminary who are ready to be ordained in the Methodist Church. people who are already married, the same gender in marriage, and they're living into this reality, right? They're moving into the uncertainty, not because it's a certain thing, but because they live the dream, they live as if. How do we live as if the kingdom of God is a reality? The interconnectedness, the hope, and the possibility of that. How do we live into that? Linda's good friend, Deborah Crumpton, is an African-American, a black United Methodist minister, clergywoman over in Arlington, and they get together and chat, you know, once a week or so. And the other day, Linda was talking about something because it was Martin Luther King, and so the conversation came up. And Linda was struck by what Deborah said. She said, "You white people," I loved that, "you white people don't know how to wait." Isn't that interesting? She says, "You don't know how to wait. Waiting has been a reality of my life for several hundred years. But it's changing little by little, and we live into that uncertainty." She defined, I was thinking in terms of that maybe we need to clarify that a little bit more, because I want to suggest we don't know how to hope. We find ourselves up against fear and uncertainty, and we turn back to what's certain. And so we don't face change, we stay rooted. And certainty is hopeless, not simply because it's not moving forward, but also because it's dying. The more we become certain and stay in one place, the more our lives are immobilized, and life moves around us, and life invites change, but we don't move into it. I like how Robin DiAngelo, when she wrote this book, White Fragility, right? Some of you read this book. A lot of people read this book. A lot of white people read this book during earlier on in the COVID. It was interesting what Robin DiAngelo describes as fragility. She said, "White fragility is the inability of white people to tolerate racial stress, the reality of racial stress and anxiety. When confronted with racism, white people usually manifest the fragility in a form of outrage, as a suggestion of privilege or in demonstrations or woundedness, sort of the opposite of what we might say is enduring with endurance and hope. So the hatred and anger become pretty good substitutes for fear and uncertainty." Last October 2021, Unite the Right march again was yelling out that same slogan. The white supremacists were yelling that, "You will not replace us. You will not replace us." Remember last week when I talked about do what is hard to do? I talked about walking the bridge. What's on the other side of that bridge for you? Anger, hate, discomfort, people who don't agree with you, people who are violently disagreeing with you, or on this side, doesn't matter. What's on the other side of that bridge from you? But in order to begin to heal and to restore life, we have to not walk over there and say, "Come back over here." We simply have to start walking that bridge back and forth until we begin to know what it feels like, until we begin to feel some sense of empathy past the differences, that we begin to empathize with what does connect us. I got to tell you, as a 60-something year old, here standing up as a white guy, I sometimes wonder, why am I even here? I continually begin to feel more and more obsolete the older I get. I was listening to a group as we were doing a Bible study last week. Several people shared on Zoom. They were sharing. They were older individuals in their 70s. They said, "You know, the more I try to move around in town, the more I see young adults, the more I just don't relate. The more I feel obsolete." You ever felt that before? Ageism, racism, sexism, body image. There's a lot of compare and compete in the story we tell in our life. But we got to walk that bridge that begins to recognize who's doing it, why we're doing it, why they're doing it, and to begin to offer a different way of seeing. Begin to let go of these ways of identifying ourselves and to move in a place of equanimity. When Mary Ellen was doing this little exercise in Kairos, returning back to the breath, One of the other spiritual practices that I talk about that I recommend is this daily practice. If you can only do it for a minute, or if you can do it 2 minutes twice a day, to take a deep breath, to deeply breathe in, to deeply exhale. When the thoughts come in, just remind yourself that's not who you are. We're not who we think we are. We're both more than that, and we're none of that. We live more in unknowing than we live in knowing, because our conditioning would say we know, but no, we don't. We only know in relationship, and right now that's broken. Enduring what is hard to endure. Let's see this next slide here as we start to wrap up something. Nourished beginnings. Muriel Rukeyser was an activist, a social activist, and a poet back in the middle of the 20th century. Not all things are blessed, but the seeds of all things are blessed. The blessing is in the seed. Well, that's what I'm talking about, right? This idea that when we plant our feet into the path that moves towards uncertainty, we begin to open up what's possible. If we stay put, there's nothing there particularly inherent that's hopeful. It's only when we plant it. Nourish the beginnings of things. This next one is one of my favorite. I love this image. It's over in London. I don't remember the name of the street. They repaint those windows. There's always a different display on those windows. But the let's adore and endure each other is always there. Do you know what the root word of adore is? The root word of adore is to worship. But if you look at worship, it doesn't mean idolize. And that's what we get wrong all the time as religious people, right? We're always idolizing stuff. The minute we like an idea, it becomes concrete and it's an idol. Worship means worth, to give worth. How do we give worth to one another? And then how do we endure that? That's our path. That's what we're invited to do, walking that bridge back and forth. Find the inherent worth of every individual. We all share it. And then endure that narrative, the uncertainty of it, live into it. I'm going to get down to this last, one more quote here. Oh, I love this quote by Mae Sarton. Return to the most human. Nothing else will nourish the torn spirit, the bewildered heart, the angry mind. And from the ultimate duress, pierced with the breath of anguish, speak for love. Rumi has this wonderful little image, this wonderful little story where he says, sit, shut up and listen. Sit, shut up and listen. You're drunk and you're standing on the edge of the sea of the roof. Sit, shut up and listen. You're drunk. Can you imagine saying that to somebody, right? You're up there with a friend. You're drunk. You're standing on the edge of the roof. I love that image because that's where we are, right? We are drunk with the intoxication of the toxic realities we live in. We're drunk with the sense in which we think we know the answers and the comfort of our certainty. And what we often don't see is the edge of the roof we're standing on. We have to sit. We have to listen. We have to approach that bridge and both sides with this unknowing as opposed to knowing. Last quote, because it's mine. T-Mac Uke, you like my rap name? T-Mac Uke. You are not what you think is wrong with you. If you are narcissistic, you are not what you think is right with you. Deep peace requires trust and equanimity, the willingness to transform our reactionary tendencies into responsive attentiveness. This is the hard work that we have to do in radical friendship in order to open everyone up to the path of the kingdom of God, to the path of shalom. That's the hardest part. That's the practice. We're not who we think we are. We'll find it better when we open up into relationship, even in the hard places. Amen.